Welcome to this week's teaching from Exchange Church in the heart of Belfast.
Hi there, and it's really good to be with you again. We continue our series here on heroes of the Bible and just learning from the lives of great heroes of our faith. Things that we can learn about people that we can transfer and learn and how that helps us. Today we're going to talk about Daniel. You know, I've really enjoyed this series. I loved delving into the lives of people and Daniel. So what do you think of whenever you hear about Daniel? I can't, being brought up in a good Christian home, sent off to Sunday school and Good News Club, I bet you can all think of the song about Daniel was a man of prayer. Daily he prayed three times. Remember that song? Well, we're going to talk about that later on. We're going to talk about his rhythm of prayer, his life, how God just the lion's mouth. That will be a reference for people who remember that little children's chorus. But Daniel was a young man when he was carried away from Jerusalem to Babylon. He lived as an exile there for the rest of his life. He saw the great kings of the Babylonian and Medo-Persian Empire rise and fall. He saw his fortunes ebb and flow as well. He escaped death in miraculous ways, and he had some of the most remarkable and amazing prophetic revelations that we read anywhere in the Bible. But what I want to really try to do today is for us to get a sense of Daniel, what made him tick, to understand the message of the whole book, and actually the message is the messenger. Daniel's life is a message, and what we see and what's contained in the book of Daniel is a reflection of Daniel's relationship with God. You see, for me, the book of Daniel is first and foremost about what is true power and true glory. Because as we read the book of Daniel, what we read is about kings and kingdoms rising and falling. We see proud men brought low, we see humble men promoted, and we see a plan that extends to cosmic proportions and dwarfs any earthly kingdoms or achievements. We see that God is over it all. And when I read Daniel, it lifts my eyes up to see the true seat of power. It quietens my voice and my hubris to see everything as part of God's great plan for mankind. You see, he is the true king. He's the one who deserves honor and worship. He establishes kings, and his kingdom is one that will last forever. Daniel tells us that there is a reality beyond what we see, a reality that in fact is more real than this. And this book, don't forget, was written in the context of exile. God's chosen nation, Israel, had been overcome. The temple and the walls of Jerusalem were lying in ruin. The people had been carried away to a foreign land, and it appears, if you like, that the great Babylonian Empire was the real seat of power. Here, the chosen ones of God were subjugated and naturalized. The people of promise were colonized with the culture, the values, and the teachings of this new kingdom. And it is here that we find Daniel and his friends. See, Babylon in those days was the center of learning and education. It was the cultural powerhouse of the earth. It was the powerhouse of the arts and of literature, of architecture. The great hanging gardens, you remember, were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. This was the rudder that steered cultural and military and economic direction of the whole known world. And here we find this young man, Daniel. Daniel, taken away from his family, taken away from his home, along with his three friends, he finds himself miles from Jerusalem and enlisted in perhaps the greatest education program the world had seen to that date. There he learned about the arts, literature, mathematics, linguistics, statecraft. This was a special place. This was more prestigious than Oxbridge or Harvard or any Ivy League college. And actually, this was a really clever way for Babylon to colonize the thinking and culture of the conquered nations while benefiting from their wisdom. It did two things. You see, what it did to their captors was it demonstrated the abundance, the wisdom, the beauty, and the affluence of Babylon. And it naturalized these people to make them part and give them a different way of viewing the world. So it changed how they thought. But also what they did was they said, we're going to give these people the best so that they get the best food, the best things, the best education, and they would reap the benefits. Because they intended to shape the thinking of the people that they had exiled. They wanted to shift their identity, no longer to be seen as children of Israel, but to be seen as Babylonian. But Daniel and his friends had a different reference point. They were different. And we jump into Daniel chapter 1. I'm going to read a few verses, chapter 1, verses 5, 8, and then 12 through 20, the story of Daniel and his friends when they were in Babylon at the start. And it says this: the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Verse 8 says, but Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. Isn't that amazing? So the guard took away their choice food and wine, and they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams and all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the king. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Those were his three friends. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his old kingdom. What a story. Here you are, this is the best that the world had. This is the best learning, the best food, the best environment to be in. We will show you how great we are. Daniel says, no, I've got a different way of doing it. And what we see is that he was 10 times better than what Babylon could offer. And we see God giving and blessing over and over again. Because Daniel, I see, was a guy who constantly wanted to understand, and he looked for understanding not in the learning that was found in the wisdom of Babylon, but in his relationship with God. This was the central driver in Daniel's life. His relationship with God defined who he was, and he didn't allow the circumstances to define his reality, but rather he sought God, allowed God to reveal things as they truly are. What about us? What about me and you? Do we really seek to see things and understand them as they truly are? Because just like Daniel, we live, I believe, today in a world that wants to colonize our thinking, to shape our identity, to tell us how we should see ourselves, to see ourselves first and foremost as part of this cultural moment rather than part of God's family. We too, if you like, live as exiles in this world, are a long way from our true home, which is heaven. Our minds and affections, our outlook, are colonized by the pervading environment in which we live. Almost imperceptibly, it shapes our thinking, whispers our identity, it aligns our values with that of the world around us. It tells us what is right and what's wrong, what attitudes are acceptable, what aren't acceptable. It shapes your choices and offers us so much, yet comes up so short. The problem with that is, isn't it, is that it's so innate, it's so implicit in everything we do that we end up not even realizing the effect it's having on us. We don't even see the world and our God and his rule in it all. Exiled from God, if you like, looking for something that slipped away, our thoughts and identity get shaped by this world. And this world's like the water we swim in. So how do we respond? And I love this story. David Foster Wallace was an American author and a writer. And he gave the commencement address in Kenyon University in 2005, and he told this story, and I think it's great. He said there were two young fish swimming along, and they happened to meet an older fish swimming the other way, and the older fish nods at them and says, morning boys, how's the water? The two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over to the other one and goes, what's water? And I think society's a wee bit like that. We swim along in it day in, day out, not actually paying attention to what's around us. What is water? And many things can carry us away from that awareness of what's really going on, the stress around us, bereavement, tragedy, loss, shame, disappointment, stuff, acclaim, money, position, comfort, amusement, indulgence, you name it, all of these things can shift our attention away. And Foster Wallace in that speech, this is a long one, so stick with me, I'm going to read this because I think it makes a really salient point. Now this is coming from a guy who wasn't a Christian. He was brought up in an atheist home. He was searched all his life for meaning. He tried Christianity in various churches. He was a member of a Mennonite church, but I don't really know where he stood before he died. But this is what he said. He said, "There's something else that's weird but true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism." This is this guy speaking. "There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much everything else you worship will eat you alive. Listen, if you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Worship power, and you will end up feeling weak and afraid, and you will never, and you will need ever more power over others to numb you to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you'll end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious thing about all these forms of worship is that they're not evil or sinful. It's that they're unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware of what you're doing. And the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums merrily along in a pool of fear and anger and frustration and craving and worship of self. Our present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom, all to be lords of our tiny skull-sized kingdoms alone at the center of all creation." How much truth there is in what this guy's written. To me, he's described life away from God. And in many ways, the book of Daniel portrays the kings of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, and Darius as lords of their tiny skull-sized kingdoms alone at the center of all creation, unaware of the true source of power. And the first half of the book of Daniel tells us five big stories that demonstrate over and over again how small and skull-sized their kingdoms were and how great the kingdom of God really is. The first one, there's the story in Daniel 2 of Nebuchadnezzar's dream of a statue. And then there's the golden statue that he orders everyone to worship, and Daniel's friends are thrown into the fiery furnace. There's another part where Nebuchadnezzar has a dream which Daniel interprets, and Nebuchadnezzar lives as a wild animal for 7 years till he realizes who's on the throne. Then we read about Belshazzar's feast and the hand that writes on the wall, and finally about King Darius and the plot against Daniel and how he was cast into the lion's den. So what I want to do really quick is just to show you these principles and the rhythm of what it is the book says and how Daniel lived and experienced life. So the first one was that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of a statue, and he dreamt, well, he didn't tell anybody the dream. He wanted someone to tell him what the dream was and give them the interpretation. Only Daniel could do that after he prayed. And he dreamt of a great statue whose head was gold, the chest and arms were silver, the belly and thighs were bronze, and the legs were iron, and the feet was a mixture of clay and iron. And that this interpreted this as representing future kingdoms. The head, we see, was the Babylonian Empire, which is where he was then. Then the silver chest and arms was the Medo-Persian Empire. Then the bronze lay thighs was the Greek Empire and Alexander the Great. And then the iron and the clay mixed with iron was the Roman Empire. Because this showed that there were different kingdoms that would come and go. But what was in this was great. There was a stone that says it wasn't cut with human hands. It came and it smashed that statue and grew into a great mountain that took over the whole world. And ultimately, the response of Nebuchadnezzar was in Daniel 2 and 47, he said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." The result of all of that was that you had the king recognizing there was a power and authority above him. We see the same thing with Daniel's friends in the fiery furnace. you remember that they said that they had to bow down and worship this great statue that he had set up. And because they didn't, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, those three friends, they were thrown into the fiery furnace. Then we remember that there was another in the fire, that there was a fourth man, and that they came out with, it says, with not even the smell of smoke on their clothes, and they were rescued, and that God was with them. And Nebuchadnezzar's response was, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. You see, again, the response was, actually, we're talking about worshiping this, but there's a God above who really needs to be worshipped. Then there was another time whenever in Daniel 4 where he talks about Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of a great tree that was chopped down. And ultimately that was, Daniel interpreted that and showed that he said, you're going to lose your mind. You're going to live like a cattle in the field. You're going to eat grass and the dew will be wet in your hair. After 7 years, you'll come back to your senses and your kingdom will be restored to you. And it says this in Daniel 4:34-36. This is Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion, a kingdom that endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases. With all the powers of heaven and the peoples of earth, no one can hold back his hand or say to him, what have you done? Do you see the rhythm? Each time the result of all of these things is that God's glory, that he's above all kingdoms and he's got the real power. Then we read in chapter 5 about Belshazzar's feast, and it says that there was a hand appeared. And the hand wrote on the wall, it said, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And they said, what does this mean? And this was Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's son. And it meant that you've been weighed in the balance, you've been found wanting, your kingdom's divided, and it's going to be given to the Medes and Persians. And that very night, we're told that the kingdom, that great Babylon, fell, and there was a new king, Darius, came in. And it was Darius then who was on the throne whenever we get to Daniel in the lion's den. Can you see a rhythm here? Can you see the kingdoms come, kingdoms go? Men lift themselves up and think they're all that, but God says, I'm above it all, and he wants to remind us who we really are. And then we find that there was a plot against Daniel. They said, the only way we're going to catch this guy out if it's something to do with his God. So they said that no one was allowed to pray to any god or man other than the king for 30 days. Imagine somebody said that on pain of death. Somebody said, now you cannot pray for 30 days or you're going to die. What would you do? This is what Daniel did in Daniel 6 and verse 10. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open towards Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Do you know what? Daniel would rather die than not pray. And we know the story about how he was taken, he was thrown into the den of lions. We know that God rescued him, that God just shut the lion's mouth. And then he came out the next day, and King Darius, when he saw God's deliverance of Daniel, he says this in Daniel 5, 25 through 27, says, then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language of all the earth, may you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. Can you see the pattern in all of this? And this, in the most famous story of all, Daniel in the lion's den, we're reminded that Daniel would rather die than not pray, because this was such an intrinsic part of who he was. Without prayer and communion with God, Daniel would cease to fully be himself. And Daniel saw that this was the thing that he could not do without. He could do without fine wine. He could do without all of the food. He could do with all of these things, but do without God's presence? Never. It says there that he prayed 3 times a day, as was his custom since early days. This was a daily appointment. This is something that had gone on for years. This is something that had gone on for probably 65, 70 years. Daniel's appointments with God shaped his life. And his life, if you like, fitted around his time with God rather than his time with God fitting around life. Oh boy, that's one I could do with, isn't it? What's the architecture of your life like? What does your life look like? What's my life look like? Because for Daniel, the foundation of the building of Daniel's life was in the morning spent with God. The pillars of in the day and the roof of protection in the evening of his time spent with God. His life was built on his relationship with God, and no power and no attack and no threat would ever compromise this, because Daniel realized where real power lies. He realized that battles are not fought in palace courts against other people, but we must, like Daniel, bring our battles, our foes, our weaknesses, where? To the field of prayer. See, because if you try to fight a battle anywhere else, failure is certain. If he had tried to stand up to other people, if he had tried to do all the stuff, he would have failed. Defeat is inevitable, but what a difference when the contest is waged in the presence of the one who is all powerful. What a shift in the outcome, and the calm assurance that fills the life that marches on its knees. Ours is not the battle of flesh and blood, but as the Apostle Paul reminds us in Ephesians 6 and 2, it says, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. See, Daniel knew the true foe. The battle wasn't with the advisors or the dignitaries. It wasn't with the king. He knew another seat of power. He knew another battlefield where the real fighting was done. It was here that he gained understanding and insight. This was a man, we're told, was greatly beloved by God. And in his presence, in the presence of the one who knew him and of perfect law, love, he saw revelation. He saw deliverance and he saw blessing. I'm reminded a bit of Churchill's famous speech. You remember? We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them on the landing grounds. You remember it? We will fight them in the fields and in the streets. We'll fight them in the hills. We will never surrender. What I would say from a Christian's perspective, from our perspective, with respect to our true foes, we fight on our knees. We fight in his presence. Here and here alone is the seat of all power. Here and here alone do the powers and kingdom of this world turn. Here is the hottest and most important battle of all, the battle for the soul and the spirit of all mankind. In season, out of season, day in, day out, morning, noon, night, Daniel showed up whether he felt like it or not. This discipline of intimacy with God shaped his life, and it should shape ours. It molds our thoughts and forms new things. Wouldn't it be great to just stop? Our frantic, hurried, inculcated lives, just to pause and be still, to rest in God's presence, to be aware that he's on the throne. Shifts our perspective, doesn't it? Realigns all our priorities, and it'll provide a clarity that no activity or busyness can ever bring. See, prayer makes us more God conscious and less other conscious, whatever that other is. Whether it's self, whether it's sin, shame, stress, difficult people, health, global pandemics. Prayer aligns our view of the world with God's view, and it replaces our desires with his. See, Daniel saw the power and glory of God, and from here, all other foes were diminished in their stature. How do you see the world? How's the water? Will you let it shape you, or will you anchor yourself to this fixed reference point? Will you see the real source of power, the big plan? Because with this fixed point, which is God, who's above everything, whatever, how big it looks, the other stuff completely changes. You see, in God's presence, position, recognition, praise gets much less important, doesn't it? Nice food, comfortable life, less important. Pleasing people in so-called positions of power and marching to the beat of the drum of whatever society says you should do pales into insignificance once, like Daniel, as we're told in Daniel 7 and verse 9, you have seen the Ancient of Days. Once you encounter, like Daniel tells us he did in chapter 7 and verse 13 through 14, he said that he saw one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations and languages should serve him, which shall not pass away. His kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed. Once you've seen the King of Kings, once you've seen the Ancient of Days, Once you've spent time in the presence of one like the Son of Man, you realize where the real power stands. And this is how Daniel was able to stand in the presence of what was the greatest, most powerful man on the earth, in confidence, and say, I am not going to do what you're going to tell me to do, because he knew where real power lay. See, Daniel was a man who knew God and was known by God. Three times in the Bible, we're told that he was a man greatly beloved by God. And for over 65 years, he lived as an exile under different kings, yet he lived his life anchored in his connection with God. He never lost his identity. First and foremost, he was a follower of God. We're told he longed for home. He wept for his nation. He repented on their behalf. But he doubled down on his commitment to God. I think Daniel's life's a great pattern for us. It's a great pattern of how we thrive in a challenging environment and live with a different reference point, an external fixed reference point that judges everything else that we do. Daniel recognized, you see, that if God oversees everything, then he will promote and bless, and that all he had to do was just to stay close to him. Isn't that great? See, Daniel's identity was shaped by his intimacy with God. And his intimacy with God transformed how he viewed and interacted with the world and the culture in which he lived. There's a lovely quote from Bishop Winnington Ingram, and it says, "It is a wonderful historical fact that the man of prayer, or men of prayer, have always been the men of power in the world." It's a wonderful historical fact that the men of prayer have always been the men of power in the world. Let's not confuse these seats of power. Daniel reminds us that God is on a throne, that there is a kingdom above all things, that he rules, that he promotes, and he brings low. God is over all. So Daniel's is a life that points us to the source of real power and reminds us, let's get plugged in. I would really encourage you to read the book of Daniel. There's some challenging stuff in it, particularly the prophecies near the end, but it's worth reading. And as I read it, I'm encouraged to know that as I put myself into the presence of God regularly, then I realign and I reset and I listen and I can hear from him. Hopefully you've been encouraged as much as I've been encouraged in preparing this and sharing it with you today. I hope that you're really blessed. And what I would really encourage you, take some really simple practical thing away from this. Can you take a point, perhaps three times in a day, start your day, finish your day in God's presence, but you see in the busyness of all the day and all the stuff's going on, do you have time to stop, to pause, to redirect and incline your heart to God? And say, what do you want me to do? Where does the real source of power live in this thing that I'm facing right now? And I am assured that you will see the blessing of God flow in your life. Be blessed in Jesus' name. It's been great to be with you.